No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008 or Skype us at BBS Radio 1. That's BBS RadioOne. Normally our show deals with issues like statehood for the District of Columbia and politics, but today, since it's Valentine's Day, we have two very, very special guests. First up is Dr. Bonnie Eaker Weil, a relationship expert and author of the book Adultery, the Forgivable Sin, who will give us some relationship advice for Valentine's Day. And then we'll hear from Jules Martinez Hurst, an etiquette consultant who will help us understand manners in today's ever-changing world. So please call in with your comments and questions and be part of the conversation. Again, the number is 888-628-6008, or you can Skype us. But before I go any further, let me show some proper etiquette and introduce my wonderful co-host, Maria Sanchez. Hi, Maria.
Hello, Michael. Thank you so much.
I hope you're warm and comfy out there in California.
We sure are. Sunny and 80 degrees. We've been having a heat wave. We need El Nino back, but, you know, what can I say? We're not going to complain. But happy Valentine's Day to you.
Thank you.
And happy birthday to Mrs. Brown. And happy birthday to my mother, Viola, who's 83 years old today.
Wow. God
and happy Valentine's Day to Dr. Bonnie, who was my relationship correspondent back in my terrestrial radio days. And we met over her writing the book Adultery, the Forgivable Sin. But she also has a book called Makeup, Dope, Breakup. So you can kind of see where her orientation is, which is why I find her so valuable. Welcome, Dr. Bonnie.
So much, Marie, and thank you so much for that. But, you know, we were always a very good team because I think you think about relationships similar to the way I do.
It's, yes, indeed. I just haven't been as successful as my two colleagues have been that are sharing their airwaves today. So I always admire and am inspired by folks who can make it work. So Dr. Bonnie, would you tell us the premise behind your tome, Adultery, the Forgivable Sin, because it really is something that a lot of couples can't get over. I know I couldn't in my marriage. That was the deal breaker for me. And my mother has an adage. She was raised on a farm and she wanted me to share this, that her mom told her, sometimes a hen, chicken, will eat their own eggs. And once they do that, you can't break them of the habit. So you have to wring their neck and have them for dinner. And she said, and that's a man. Once he is unfaithful, you can't cure him of that.
Now, I don't agree with that because I think that it can be treated and it can be cured. And my father is a good example because he cheated for 25 years and then he stopped for the next 25 and never cheated again.
Now, you talk about how that can become generational, too.
Yes, it is. Definitely the brain chemicals are hereditary, as I've mentioned before. And because they're hereditary, it's very important to know that I call that the biochemical craving for connection. And what it means when you say biochemical craving, it means that the brain chemicals are hereditary. The good news is that you can fix them, though, and change them. That's the good news. So even though they are hereditary, if you have psychotherapy, which I do for people, and besides psychotherapy, we also test people. We test their serotonin, their dopamine, and we see their blood sugar is always off. Anyone that's addicted usually is addicted to sugar. Remember Clinton with the donuts? Mm-hmm. And so the reason it's forgivable is because usually it's some kind of a chemical imbalance and an emotional emptiness that is passed down from generation to generation. In other words, no one commits adultery that's not in some sort of pain, but I'm not excusing it and condoning it. The person that is cheating, like my father, has to want to stop. And it's not in their control because it's a biochemical craving for connection. But with help, with psychotherapy, with diet, with exercise, with supplements, certain vitamins, they can be cured and treated and never cheat again for the rest of their life.
It almost sounds, though, like the Twinkie defense.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, the sugar made me do it.
Well, that's what I mean by everybody always, you know, kind of says to me, oh, okay, so you're condoning it, you're excusing it. I'm not doing that. I'm saying that there is reasons. The blood sugar is always, it's off in people like this because they are very stressed out and they have no place for the stress. So when they cheat, it's like a high. It's like an endorphin rush. It's kind of like the way women are when they go shopping. You know, mm-hmm. you get like a rush. It's the same rush when you get from gambling, if you're a gambler, or if you're committing financial infidelity, or if you drink, you're an alcoholic, you get a dopamine rush from alcohol. It's the same thing. But it's not okay to do, and it is forgivable, but we tell you not to do it. If you have done it, it's forgivable if you get the help. It's not forgivable if you keep doing it.
So, Michael, is your take on that?
Well, I'm a diabetic, so I guess I have a built-in excuse. Not that I have, if Mrs. Brown is listening, not that I've ever been unfaithful. But yeah, I find that very interesting. I think that we don't think of it that way. And, Dr. Bonnie, what I'd like to ask you, I know that in some Scandinavian countries, adultery is not really unacceptable. I know that they were going to do a genome project in Scandinavia at one time because people were so homogeneous. And they were going to pay the Scandinavians to do it, but they didn't want to do it because people really don't want to know who their fathers are. Adultery is something that's very acceptable in their society, and people, when they're married, take responsibility for the children that their wives have, and they don't have them DNA tested, and, you know, it's kind of culturally accepted. So how much does culture play into this whole thing?
That's a wonderful question that you just asked. Yes, you know, culturally, it's okay in some societies. And actually, you know, I have a private practice. You probably know, Maria knows, I do this all over the world by phone. And I have a private practice also in New York City. And sometimes people will come to me and they say to me, you know, well, we both want to swing and we both believe in adultery. Is it okay? Culturally, it's okay. And it's okay individually if each couple is okay with it, you know. Then they think it's okay. If one person thinks there's a problem, there's a problem. Right. That's how you describe it in family therapy terms. So what we see here, culturally, it's okay, then it's accepted. Or if a couple says, I'm okay with it, they're both okay with it. But what's interesting is, you know, I did a book signing in France. Now, you would think that adultery was accepted in France, correct? Mm-hmm. All the mistresses that everybody has?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't know if you know, but they actually have a time of day called Cinq on Sept. Between 5 and 7 in the evening is when the men have affairs with their mistresses, and then they come home after 7 and have dinner with their wives. When I had my book signing, they were around the corner, the line. I was shocked, and all these women were in line saying to me, I can't believe that we accepted here, but none of us really accept it. We all feel terrible, and we have pain every night when they're out between 5 and 7, and they explained to me that Cinq on Sept. So even if it's culturally okay, you know, there are people that it just doesn't sit right with them. So it really has to be the both people have to be okay with it. And in Europe, they're much more understanding. It's more accepted than it is here. And I would say to you that monogamy is a conscious decision to stay faithful. And love is a conscious decision, just like monogamy is. It's a conscious decision that you've decided, even though you're tempted, you are going to stay faithful.
Well, that's what I think separates the men from the boys, and not that adultery is relegated to just men. So, I mean, anybody could be guilty of it. And that's why I have a little trouble with the sugar issue, because we all have choices, and we can default to our brains, or we can default to our hearts, or we can default to the urges of our flesh.
See, that's a good point that you're making about sugar. But the reason I say it's a biochemical craving for connection and you don't have any control, I don't say it because I want to excuse it. When you are having a lot of sugar, it's very addictive. You know, they've done brain scans on some of my patients, and it looks the same as when someone's on opiates, someone's on cocaine. The brain lights up the same way when people have sugar. So when they're addicted to sugar, okay, they don't have control unless they detox. And when they're addicted to sugar, as an example, or they have a lot of stress and their blood sugar is totally in balance and they're not doing anything to correct it, they are not in control of their behavior. That is what we're saying. In other words, when the blood sugar is not balanced, and anyone that's very stressed, that's why a lot of politicians and President Clinton and people like that are under severe stress. I mean, every president has turned gray in the office,
right?
You know, while they're president. Okay, so they have tremendous amounts of stress. They travel a lot. They're away from their families. All these things factor in to the blood sugar. They're not eating on time. They're eating the wrong foods. Then you have a blood sugar issue. When blood sugar is not balanced, your decision-making and judgment are completely off. You have a rational thought process. That is what I'm saying about adultery. So I'm saying it's not a rational thing. The person that's committing adultery is not saying, okay, I want to make a conscious decision that I'm going to stay in love with my partner and I'm not going to stray and I'm not going to jeopardize my relationship. You have to be you have to have good decision-making and judgment. You can't when your blood sugar is off. That is why I'm saying it's a chemical reaction to stress, and then emotional as well.
So, Dr. Bonnie, after you take care of their biochemistry, if you will, could you walk us through how you work with a couple to move forward, to forgive, and to heal?
Yes. Well, I think that's also a great question, because, you know, today is Valentine's Day, and as I was talking to my husband, I said, you know, I'm going to do a radio show today on Valentine's Day. And he said, you know, that's perfect. He said, because Valentine's Day, not only is it about love, it's about forgiveness. And forgiveness is a gift you give yourself. So today is a perfect day. And I believe that the reason adultery is forgivable, if you treat it properly and you agree that you have a problem and you get the proper help, it can be forgiven. It won't be forgotten, and it shouldn't be forgotten so that you never do it again. But I think we need to stop bastardizing and blaming and shaming people that are committing adultery, just like we did with alcoholism many, many years ago, and start looking at what are the problems causing this, and can we do something about it? Because 52% of women commit adultery and 70% of men. So, I mean, that's a lot. One partner in 80% of marriages commits adultery, and 65% of people that get divorced, it's because of adultery. So, I mean, because the whole world is stressed out, as you know. Everybody's stressed out about money, about different things. We live in a world with terrorism. I mean, it's not an excuse, but what are you doing with your stress? Well, people are looking for a high. They're looking for a drug. And when you have a relationship with someone that's not your partner, you are going to get a different kind of high than you get with a partner that you're with. So what I try to teach people when they commit adultery, we take a test. We take a dopamine and a serotonin test. Serotonin affects mood, and dopamine affects motivation and drive and whether you feel happy or not. And every one of those people that we have tested have not been in balance. The serotonin and dopamine have to be in balance. They're not in balance, and every single person that has committed adultery that I have tested has had blood sugar, which is called hypoglycemia, which is low blood sugar. And it's interesting because in one of my books, Can We Cure and Forgive Adultery, the one where we tested people with serotonin and dopamine, and I describe all that, there was a judge who had a divorce court. He was very smart, and he said, you know what, I'm going to test all the people in my divorce court. And he found 75% of the people that came to his court to get divorced had hypoglycemia.
Huh.
And after he made them all get tested, only 25% got divorced. So that's an example, and I have it in my book, and I didn't do the study, but somebody else did. And so that tells you something, that it can be treated, it's a disease, and it's so prevalent, because when we fall in love, we love the feeling, but we don't realize that to stay in love is an effort, and we don't want to make an effort. We just want to feel that same high we felt when we first fell in love, when the hormones were just doing the work. So I explain to people, after they get the test, then they go on a diet. They have a special blood sugar diet where they're not allowed to have any sugar. They detox. They can't have, you know, wine, things like that. They can't have anything that's white. No white flour, no white sugar, no white rice, no white bread. And they also do an exercise program, 40 minutes, four times a week. It can be walking. And when we do this, we also, you know, they have psychotherapy with me. I see each person alone, or I talk to them on the phone. I have people from Singapore. I have people from Norway, Israel, all over. And I talk to each one alone, and then the two of them together. And most of them will tell me, I'm not in love with my partner anymore. And what it is they're not in love with themselves. They feel so terrible. They look for a quick fix. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I do is I teach them attachment skills. Attachment skills are a 20-second hug will give you the same dopamine thrill that you get when you commit adultery. Just 20 seconds, and everybody that's listening can try this. They stand up and hug their partner for 20 seconds, and you will feel the same rush that you get from adultery. Also, a 30-second kiss. You will feel the same oxytocin. It's called the cuddle hormone. It's the same hormone when you're breastfeeding. Very important, and that makes you feel bonded, safe, happy, and very close to your partner. And these are the things, when I say you feel very close to your partner, you feel safe and bonded. It's the same feeling that people say they have when they have an affair. So these are the things that we do. And then the other thing is, if there's any contact with the mistress, or with the paramour, the person has to tell you that they've had contact. Either they've had contact or the person has called them. There are no secrets. And every day they have to say, I've had no contact, if there has been no contact. And by doing that, the person that was betrayed begins to trust. So that's how you get the trust. The other thing is they have to turn over their computer, their password, their phone, and the person that was betrayed has to have full access. If they're not allowed to do that, then you know they're hiding something.
Wow.
Well, you know, two things really strike me, Doctor. One is that when you talk about the diet you just laid out is, you know, the diet they try to keep me on as a diabetic as well. And my problem, of course, is just the opposite. It's high blood sugar and not low blood sugar. But
yeah.
They try to do the same thing with diabetic, yeah. is break that cycle of sugar, no white flour, no yeah. rice, no, you know, low carbs, slowly metabolized carbs. So I find that very interesting. And also the fact that you use the example of President Clinton, because I've actually been in politics a long time, and I've been to the Oval Office. And I can tell you, nothing goes on in the Oval Office that dozens of people don't know about immediately. It's not a private place. I think a lot of people think that what went on with Monica Lewinsky was private, but it couldn't have possibly been. There's Secret Service agents all over the place, and the place is monitored. And, you know, so you know, that's something that always struck me about that situation, is that the president must have known that, you know, that this wasn't going to be something that was
private,
kept in confidence. This was going to be something that was known, and he went ahead anyway. So
yes,
that whole addictive
thing.
That's
a very good point. That's thrill-seeking, Michael. Michael, that's one of the biggest, you just mentioned something so important I forgot to mention. Thrill-seeking is what the forbidden fruit, and why people, they actually get a thrill out of something that's living on the edge, and that was Clinton. That's you're absolutely right. But that's part of it. That's why people, you know, cheat, because they don't have the rational thought process. But the thrill-seeking is coming from another hormone called vasopressin. And a lot of your presidents and senators, you know, that like that thrill-seeking, and they have a lot of vasopressin, which is the risk-taking hormone. It has to do with power and risk-taking. The more powerful they are, the more risk-taking. The more risk-taking, the more powerful they feel.
Right. I can see that.
And it sounds like adrenaline junkies.
Yes. It's exactly what Michael just said about the Oval Office. And yes, and you're 100% right. Because those hormones are going like that, they've done studies and they found more vasopressin in the politicians, the senators, the congressmen, the president. Because, you see, they do take risks. Mm-hmm. And they take risks because they feel powerful. They're powerful because they take risks. You know, just like, you know, some of the governors that have, you know, gotten in trouble for prostitution rings and all. And, you know, Elliot Spitzer, that was, someone in New York City. It's the same thing. Why do people do this? I mean, they know they could get caught, but they don't think of it that way. They're not rationally thinking. They're on a high. They're looking for that high, and they get the high from living on the edge, from thrill-seeking.
So, Dr. Bonney, what would you say is your success rate? Not that what you, in other words, your skills, your power, your mindset, it sounds very kind of foolproof, but then we're still dealing with humans and emotions.
I have a 98% rate of couples who stay together and are happy
around
this issue of adultery. And let me tell you, the ones that come back are the ones, and this is weird. Don't even ask me how this happens. It's about 2 years. 2 years is when I get the phone call back, when they go off the diet and they don't have any more therapy and they don't take the supplements. 2 years. Is about what it takes, and they come back again. And they say to me, I went off my diet, I'm eating all the sugar, you know, because they get stressed out, especially if they're politicians, you know, they're very stressed, they travel, a lot of Wall Street guys, they're constantly stressed every day. So they take sugar, you know, like if you take a donut, it gives you a rush, just like if they take a drink of alcohol, beer, it gives them a rush. And 2 years later, they're cheating again. So it really is the one, and that's why I started to study this, because I saw that the ones that really came in and wanted, or called me on the phone and wanted to really get better, they got better, but then they slipped again. And why? Because they went off the program. There are two supplements that are very interesting that we use. Now, I'm going to ask everyone that's listening, not please go and order this, because one of them is over the counter, and another one has to be a prescription, because I don't want people just going and doing this. When we look at people, we do blood work, and we give them the amounts of these things depending upon individually what their numbers look like in terms of serotonin, dopamine, or vitamin D, or B12 or B6. So it's not for anybody to just go and buy, but they can get tested and do this the right way. Lithium orotate is a supplement over the counter, which is incredible. What it does is it gives a lot of the adulterers clarity of thinking. They get more rational. It actually also helps with post-traumatic stress disorder, which a lot of the betrayed are in. And then oxytocin, which is that cuddle hormone I told you that you can get when you do a 30-second kiss. But my patients don't kiss and cuddle. They don't even go near their partners because they're so busy cheating. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we give them the oxytocin. A doctor, an MD, does it because I can't prescribe. And they take oxytocin by mouth. And the adulterer only is allowed to take it when they're at night, when they're with their partner, not, you know, with anyone else other than the one that they live with or married to. And the partner takes it also, and it helps with post-traumatic stress. The people that have been cheated on, as you could imagine, are throwing emotional darts constantly. and they're in pain all the time for months and months, sometimes years. So the oxytocin helps them think about it, not obsess, you know, think about it less so they don't obsess. And both of them get more bonded to each other. So those two things have been so helpful with the testing and the different things that we do.
And what I love about your message, Dr. Bondi, is that it is filled with hope and that it is filled with opportunity and it's filled with an opportunity to have forgiveness and to move forward and to take something that may have been troubling and a deal breaker and make it part of the strength of the foundation as the commitment continues.
That's a great comment you just made, because you see, the couple has to be committed to the process of everything. It's not easy, the diet, the exercise, the supplements, and the therapy. And the therapist, which would be me, has to be committed. And I think that's what actually gets my patients better, is because I saw it with my parents. And I really believe that people can get better. And I have people that come to me and say, you know, my therapist told me that I can never change. I said, that's ridiculous. I said, that's why I'm in business in the first place. I said, the only way it can't work is if you decide that you don't want to do this. Because if an adulterer doesn't show remorse and doesn't stop cheating and doesn't want to do the work, then it can't work. But most marriages and relationships can be saved. We just have to teach the people the skills. And I teach people the skills and the tools. But the therapist has to work as hard as the people. And you have to believe in people. You have to believe in love. And I really do believe that love conquers all. I mean, my mother taught me that since I'm a little girl. I saw it with my parents. I saw that they worked for years to find out how they could get help. And my father was a sugar addict. He had a candy drawer. We used to kid with him. He had a drawer full of candy. And that's how I got my idea from.
Because let me ask you, Dr. Bonnie, the difference between men and women. More men, you gave the statistic earlier, more men do this than women. Is this a cultural thing, do you think, or is it related to our physiology? You know, Woody Allen used to say that women need a reason to have sex, men just need a place. So, you know, is that it, that men have a stronger sex drive? Or is it a cultural thing that we go, you know, kind of boys will be boys?
Well, you know, that's a great question. Also, you guys are terrific with your questions tonight. Actually, you know, women are almost catching up.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, women, it's like 52%. It wasn't like that before. Why? Because women are out in the workforce, just like men. A lot of them are CEOs, and they're stressed out beyond belief. So I really believe it has to do with stress. We don't know how to manage our stress. We also don't know how to stay in love. We know how to fall in love. And I think we have this crazy notion in this world that if we don't have feelings for our partner, we're out of love with our partner. Most of the time, we're not out of love. We're just frozen. We're numb because there's resentments. And we don't know how to discuss. I try to teach people how to fight fairly. All the people that I've seen that have adultery in their lives, they had polite marriages. They never wanted to fight. They thought they were having a great relationship because they never got mad at each other, or they didn't want to, you know, they were walking on eggshells. So we really have to learn how to fight, conflict resolve, not be afraid of fighting in a good way. And fighting gives us passion. That's how you lose passion with a person you love, because you're not fighting. You have to fight. You're two separate people. But we have to work every week on attachment skills, hugging, kissing, touching, doing all the things to recreate the same chemicals that we had when we first fell in love. You can keep recreating them, but they don't happen by osmosis.
Well, Dr. Bonnie, before we thank you and say goodbye, tell people, give them your website, give them your contact information, let our listeners know how they can get in touch with you.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'd love to hear from everyone. So my number to reach me, if you want to have a consult or ask me a question, is 212-606-3787. That's 212-606-3787. My website is www, and it's doctor spelled out, doctor, Bonnie, bonnie.com. That's info at doctor, doctor, Bonnie, bonnie.com. And if you want to make an appointment, my email is, I'm sorry, my email is info@doctorbonnie.com, and my website is www.doctorbonnie.com. www.doctorbonnie.com.
And we know that Dr. Bonnie has dinner reservations with her husband for Valentine's Day, so we wanted to make sure we honored your reservations for the two of you for your celebration.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm just going to run across the street. We have our favorite restaurant in New York City that we celebrate all our anniversaries, birthdays, and, of course, Valentine's Day. And I want to wish everybody out there and Maria, Michael, a wonderful happy Valentine's Day. And to all of you out there, don't give up on your Valentine. It's really worth it.
You're the best,
Dr.
Bonnie. Thank you so much.
So much appreciated. We hope you'll come back. We're going to take a little break here and play something from some old friends of mine, John, George, Paul, and Ringo.
And then we get Jules Hurst on with us to talk to us about the manners.
So hang with us. We'll be back in a minute. Okay, and we're back with Jules Martinez Hurst, who's an etiquette expert and is going to tell us what we need to do to have good manners in the 21st century. And I'll tell you what, as far as I'm concerned, we can't have enough good manners. Welcome to the show, Jules. Thanks for being on.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Nice to hear you again. Welcome, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Maria, for having me back.
So, Michael, if you don't mind, I'd like to let Jules start with is just some rudimentary beginning stuff that's kind of an overview for some folks, but maybe not for everybody, and that's just the simple table manners, because that seems to be more universal than anything. And this really came home to me when I was on Radio KFI in Los Angeles, and I was dating the news director at the time, we're talking 20 years ago, and I was having the dinner party in china and crystal and sterling silver, and he said to me, what can I do to help? And I said, would you mind setting the table? And this poor man who had been raised in the projects in Chicago by a single dad had no idea where to begin, and my heart just broke for him, because it's nobody's fault. Obviously, he didn't know, and here he is, an adult, a high-functioning, very talented man. And somebody like that, you'd think that they would know, but no, not everybody knows how to do that. So if you don't mind just starting with the basics in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. So the simplest thing I can begin with is when you sit down at the table, after everyone is seated, you put your napkin on your lap. If you are at someone's home, like, you know, Maria, like you said, you were hosting an event, everybody will follow your lead. So you would sit at the end of the table. Your co-host, if there is one, sits on the other end. And everybody just follows whatever you do. So when you put your napkin on the lap, everyone else does the same. So we got the napkin down. So the napkin goes on your seat when you need to excuse yourself to go to the ladies' room or the gentlemen's room. And it goes to the left of the plate when you are through. Your napkin, again, is used for dabbing, not for wiping, not for blowing the nose at the table. It is for dabbing the ends of your mouth. Next, when we have our plate setting, and especially when it's already set up, forks and knives and glassware and bread plates, and oh my gosh, it is so, all you need to remember is BMW, your bread plate is on the upper left, your meal is in the middle, and your water is on the right, just like the car, BMW. That way you will always drink from your water glass, because the last thing you want to do is when you're out with other people, drink from the wrong water glass, because then you've thrown it out from the rest of the table, and then everyone's going to know it's you that doesn't know their table manners. When it comes to all of the utensils, et cetera, always start from the furthest out, and you work your way in towards your plate. And, you know, whether it's a soup, whether it's a fork, whatever it is, the furthest out, that's where you're going to start, and you make your way in towards the plate.
And, of course, forks on the left and knives and spoons on the right.
Correct, correct. So forks are always going to be to the left of the plate or up on top for dessert, with one exception. If you're having, like, say, like a shrimp cocktail, your shrimp cocktail fork will be actually on the right-hand side. With that one exception, forks are always going to be on the left.
Ooh. And then you used to speak about the utensils that are on top of the plate, what direction they're facing.
Yes. So if you have a fork on top of the plate, like for example, for your dessert, the tines of the fork will be facing the right, and the handle of that fork will be facing the left. So when your utensils from your meal are gone, you're basically just going to take that fork and slide it down to the left of where the plate should be. And that's why the handle faces the left. The same thing if you're using a knife or a spoon. The handle of the fork or the spoon will be facing the right so that you can drag it down to where to the right of where the plate should be.
So, Michael, isn't that cool? I use BMW every day.
Well, you know, my sister, who was a gourmet cook, used to set an impeccable table. So we try to do the same. But I want to make the discussion a little broader at this point now that we've gone through the basics. And, you know, the thing for me, Jules, is that good manners show respect. And it really bothers me. I tell you, I got two pet peeves. When I'm in a restaurant and I see guys with baseball caps on, I just want to go over to them and say, didn't you have a mother?
Yes.
What are you doing? And the other thing that kills me is getting on the metro when I use the metro and seeing young men sitting down while women in heels are standing up. When I was a little boy, 6-7 years old, I used to go on the bus with my grandmother, and I used to go through this ritual where if some woman was standing, my grandmother would make me walk up to her and offer my seat. They would always look down at me and say, oh, thank you, sweetheart. No thanks. That's okay. And I would have to say to them, you don't understand. I can't go back. If I go back to my grandmother and say she doesn't want the seat, my grandmother will just push me back in the aisle and say, go convince her. And you know, it kills me. I once had to get my 9-year-old son to stand up on a tram and offer a seat to a pregnant woman because there were 20 men sitting in the car that didn't do it.
Yeah. Thank you
it
for that.
It just drives me nuts.
And that is so true. That the men will not all the time. Every now and then you will find that gentleman, but you are absolutely correct. I will go to restaurants and I will see the baseball cap on or any kind of cap on their head. They'll be on the phone. They have a beautiful woman or they're with their family, you know, sitting with them at the table, and they're still on their phone. Mm-hmm. You know, the same thing as you said, whenever you're in public transportation, a gentleman should always offer the seat to the woman. But there's also two sides to that. You know, yes, it's the gentleman, but it's sometimes also the women, too, that have an attitude of, I don't need you to, you know, well, no one's telling you, we need to give that to you. It's just a gentleman being a gentleman and let him treat you like a woman. There's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't lessen your power. So there's actually two sides to that argument, but it does start with the gentleman. And I have friends who have little boys, and they will go on, you know, quote unquote, date night, and they will train, they will teach the little boy, their son, to pull out the chair. So, and when mom goes to the ladies' room, to stand up when she leaves the table, when she comes back to the table, to stand up again. You pull out the chair, you push it in for her, you assist her. And they're training them to be men. And that's one thing we have to get back to. Manners start at home with the parents. So
but
if you don't want your child.
Jules, so, I'm in school getting my master's in psychology, and there's something that they're teaching us. It's called benign sexism. And they say that even opening a door for a woman is saying you have more power than she does. So it's insidious now that it's coming from all sides. And I disagree with it completely. I open the door for anybody. If I'm first there, I open it. I don't see who's behind me and see if it's a guy, then no, whatever. You know, I just think it's equal opportunity. But it, I don't think, Michael, when was the last time you saw somebody stand up when a woman came and left the table?
Well, you know what? I've got to tell you that I had the privilege of spending a day one time with Dan Rather and his grandson. And we took him to the he wanted to go see Obama speak. And we took him to the convention in Denver. And do you know that little boy who was 10 years old and wore a jacket and a tie? Not only did his grandfather stand up every time a woman approached, but so did he. And everybody was so impressed by that, that I tell my children all the time that manners are a really cheap way to get over, guys. You say, yes, ma'am, no, sir, and people remember that. You know, it doesn't take much effort. And it really makes you stand out. And you're right. I don't think my father ever had a woman approach him while he was seated at the table that he didn't stand up. And I must admit, I'm guilty of it. I don't always open the car door for Mrs. Brown. I don't always stand up. And I feel bad. I think we should. Because I think what manners do, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jules, is it makes you acknowledge the other person. You know, you've got to, when you hold that door open, and I would say the same, you know, that Maria, you're absolutely right. Mrs. Brown does the same thing. She'll hold the door open for anybody that's behind her. And I think it becomes contagious and it makes you say, look, I know you're there and you know,
and you
I want to respect that.
Yeah.
Yes,
right,
and you matter.
Right. And I'm acknowledging you. Exactly. And I agree. It does. It could be, you know, it is both sides that need to do this. But, you know, just again, there are certain things like in business, a gentleman is technically not supposed to stand up when a woman comes and goes on the table because in business, men and women are treated equally. And that's always a sticky situation, especially when I go to universities, because it depends on the gentleman's age. Because if the gentlemen were raised where they always stood up when a woman comes and goes, they just can't get past that. If you're talking to a gentleman who is in their early 20s, they will not stand up because it's business and I don't have to. So it's just, I think right now is such a unique time because you have a variety of generations working together. And you have the millennials who, you know, stick to the, I don't have to do this, I don't do that, women are equal, da, 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 and then the women will expect that versus somebody like, say, like a baby boomer who will stand up, who will open the door, who will wait until a woman extends her hand before a gentleman does in business. So I am just having a great time right now because you have, like, as I said, you have the different generations that are coming together and trying to, you know, work together, and each side is right and each side is wrong, and it's just the way a person was raised. And again, it goes back to the home. How were you raised? You know, the
Michael,
manners start at home.
To your point about being taught at home, I've taught my brothers, Jules, nine brothers, boy, is that Freudian, my sons, of which I have three, that they stand until their mother sits at the table. They just had me for dinner last night for Valentine's Day. And they do that now, unbeknownst to me, with their girlfriends and their girlfriends' mothers. And those women have been writing me and saying, what kind of son have you raised? I've never had somebody stand at the table until I sit down. And it's like, ooh, it's, you know, I had no idea that they were going to continue to translate this to other iterations in their life. And it makes me so proud that they're not doing it just for their mommy.
Well, you know, that's
good job.
That's true. One of the great moments is, you know, telling my son, hold the door, hold the door, hold the door, and then one day forgetting to say it and see him actually do it.
Yay.
And you go, you know, on his own, and you go, great. But I agree, it's a two-way street, Jules. I have a friend, Bob, who says that chivalry may be dead, but it was beaten to death by women. It wasn't, you know, it didn't die of natural causes. And, you know, I have a dear, dear friend who's a woman business person, and she acts like a man in business, and it served her well. If she invites me to lunch, she pays for lunch. You know, I can't tell you how many women I've been out with in business who invited me for lunch and allow me to pick up the check. I always offer to pick up the check, not only with women but with men when I'm in a business situation. But my friend Audrey will not have it. She always, you know, if you say, let me pick up the check, she'll go, no, I invited you, and she'll grab the check.
Well, that's
or
fair.
You're here giving me advice, so she'll take the check. And I'll tell you what, she's done very well in business because she knows that it is a power thing sometimes, and she accepts responsibility for being equal in business.
So on that end, Jules, refresh us about introducing, because that's something that's really can be sticky with business, introducing either colleagues or superiors or somebody, you know, who's your employee or whatever, because I know there's protocol for that.
That is correct. So unlike in social, in business, gender isn't a factor. So whoever has the higher position, their name is said first, regardless of gender. So that would be the easiest. So, you know, if you have a VP and let's say just, you know, a regular salesman, the VP's name would be Seth first. Same thing, you know, with a VP and a CEO. The CEO takes priority over the VP. And here's one thing that always tricks up people. When you have a client and the CEO, who's the most important person?
Client.
And it's the client.
Client.
Absolutely.
The
most people
call
the CEO. They're the ones, yeah. No, the client is the most important person in the organization at that point. So their name would get set first before the CEO or anyone else.
I like that.
Yeah.
Can you speak to cultural differences?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Michael.
I was just going to say, in politics, that's really a rule that's always followed. You know, you go somewhere and the most senior member of the party, if the governor and a congressman are there and you're at a state event, the governor always speaks first. There's never any gray area there. But if you're on Capitol Hill, the congressman always speaks first. So my friend, my office manager, Karen, who listens to the show, is going to kill me. I mean, the representative, she always scolds me for saying congressman, but the representative always speaks first on Capitol Hill. So, you know, that's a rule we always follow, but I don't know that we follow it socially or in business as much, and we should.
And yeah. Jules, you made the clarification that unlike social introductions, gender is not an issue with business. So does that default to in social introductions, gender is an issue?
Yeah, it is one of the factors. So let's say you have a male and a female, and they are similar in age. It's always the female's name gets spoken first, regardless of what their positions are in the workplace. If you have an older person and a younger person, it's the older person first, and that's regardless of gender. So there are different little rules when it comes to the social side.
So when you say their name first, that would be that I would say, Michael, I'd like to introduce you to Jules because Michael has seniority. Ages.
So Michael would be first.
Right. So I'm introducing Michael to you.
Correct.
Okay, so now I get that.
And at my age, you need to do it. It's just a practical matter because if you don't introduce me quickly, I may not be there very long. You know, we see this. It really bothers me, Jules, that there's this whole breakdown in society. You know, I'm watching the political debates now, and politics has always been a nasty thing. My wife and I were talking this morning about how Andrew Jackson hated the press because they thought they hounded his wife to death. You know, there's always been nastiness in politics. But I'm looking at these debates now, and I can't believe some of the things that are being said and how, you know, there's no decorum. And it's not just the candidates. It's the the supporters out there that have to shout each other down and say terrible things. And part of this show, we put this show together, and Maria's a Republican and I'm a Democrat. We put this show together because we wanted to bring people together so they could sit down and talk. But if you can't acknowledge each other and you can't do it with some decorum and sense of manners, it's not going to happen. Right. Do you think?
Oh, I completely agree. You know, I love politics, and like Maria, I too am Republican, and I have most of my friends are you know, opposite of the aisle of me. But as long as you can speak your mind, I can speak my mind, and I mean that's what's so great about this country. We can have our own opinion, and I don't have to make you feel like you're no bigger than the ant, you know, than nothing, like nothing, because I think differently than you do. That's all it is. I have my own opinion, and that's right. What being part of this great country is having my own opinion. Now we need to come together and be able to voice our opinions and do what's best for the country at large, not just for one side. But you're right. Until we can come, you know, get together and speak and with a little bit of civility, it's always going to be a fighting match, and who can put down each side. And I love this. I love politics. So I'm like you, I'm paying attention, and it's a shame that there's not more civility out there, unfortunately.
Well, I think you said something very important, and that is that I think there used to be a thing called being an American, which trumped, no pun intended, trumped everything. You know, that you could be a Democrat or a Republican and have a difference of opinion, but when it came to being an American, we all love this country, and we came together over certain issues, and I think that's going away, and it just bothers me terribly, and I think it's directly connected to this ability.
Absolutely. Say, Jules, before we sign off, we're running out of time. Would you please help promote yourself via us so that our listeners can reach out to you? Because I know
sure,
you do consulting,
absolutely.
Too.
Yes, I do. Absolutely. So you can find more information on me at juleshirst.com. That's JuleshHirst.com. And, of course, we can get social. Facebook, it's Etiquette Consulting, Inc., and Instagram, Etiquette Coach, and Twitter is Etiquette411. But Jules Hirst works as well. Google me there, and I will pop up.
Yes, and she's as attractive as she is articulate and intelligent. I have to add that, if you don't mind. And I hope that doesn't sound sexist.
thank you.
Thanks so much for being with us, Jules. We really appreciate it, and I hope you'll come back, because there's a lot more ground to cover. And I would just say to America, before I give Maria the last word, because that's the polite thing to do, is that I want everybody to hug their significant other today on Valentine's Day and be polite.
Yes. And as Dr. Bonnie Eaker Weil said, 20-second hug and a 30-second kiss keeps attachment alive. And Jules, with her civility and her manners and her etiquette, keeping that alive is moving us forward in a great way. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great week.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.